the title we might use is the original word for economics, which is oikonomo, which means the rule of the house. Actually, home economics is tautology, because economics originally meant the operations and the exchanges that went into running a household. And the presentations on this subject are going to deal with the relationship of us to our household and to our house as a tool of lifestyle. Now, feel free to ask questions. Might tell you to wait. First, we're going to start again with a survey of just kind of ask people, how many people here grew up in a single-family detached house? I mean, with the yard all the way around it. Okay, who didn't? Let's put it that way. Who didn't? Okay. The average price of a home, I think, is somewhere around $50,000 now. And at present interest rates, that requires, after down payment, about $500 a month to begin paying on a mortgage. How many people think, well, could reasonably expect to make those sorts of payments and live in the style in which they're accustomed at the present time?
Mm-hmm. In order to get that loan, you have to have an income of $25,000.
Okay, $25,000 a year, and you'd have to be able to come up with, I think most mortgages that require a 20% down payment, which, what is it for a $50,000 house? $10,000? Which is, you know, there's hardly anyone that can amass, you know, at the age of, in their 20s or, you know, their late 20s or early 30s, who can, unless they have a super income, could amass that kind of money for a down payment. So we're faced with the ironic fact that for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, housing has been a fact of life. People have always had it, and now we're a generation that can't afford to own or live in a house. And what we're going to talk about is how it's come to that, and why we are now essentially nomads, unable to afford the shelter that has been almost a human birthright since the beginning of time. Essentially, the primary functions of a house for the first few millennium, let's say up until 200-300 years ago, the primary function of a single family house has been a shelter from the weather, and to provide a source of heat for warmth and cooking. Also provide a place to sleep and a place to secure your goods. And there were a few houses in every civilization that served the functions of state or exhibited the dignity of the head of state, palaces, castles, that sort of stuff. And they were also used for security. But those sorts of buildings were not the ones that families lived in, the ones that single families lived in, the peasants. That type of housing has stayed the same from the dawn of history right up until, almost to our day, within a couple hundred years of how we live now. And in other parts of the world, it's still essentially the same. American housing history began with settlements along the Potomac River. Is that the one? Mm-hmm. The Chesapeake Bay, Potomac River, and up in the Massachusetts Bay. They were essentially houses made of available materials, indigenous materials, like all the houses in the world, and it happened to be that America was loaded with wood. So they were wood houses, log houses, squared up log houses, chink houses, a little mud, but mostly wood. And that's the way they've been right up until our present day. We've always had an abundance of wood. They were essentially the same thing. They had the same functions. They were shelter from the weather, and in the case of New England, it was quite a bit colder than it was in Europe. And they were a place. They supplied a source of heat for food and warmth. But there were two developments shortly after, or that contributed to the uniqueness of our Western house building. And I'll tell them to you. One was the dawn of a historical consciousness, and the other was the Industrial Revolution. The historical consciousness all of a sudden gave rise to what you might call style of housing. Before, houses had been built out of indigenous material with indigenous craftsmen. Everything was local. They were, you know, the architecture, the style was all very dictated by local customs and conditions and materials available. All of a sudden, with a historical consciousness, we could separate ourselves from people who lived in past times. We could examine their work, divide particular periods of history up, and we began to pay tribute to these other civilizations by imitating them. There was our country, the settlement of the architecture of America right about the turn, about the time of the Revolution, was very strongly influenced by a Greek and Roman revival. You see columns, elements of Greek and Roman architecture. And what was being done there was that elements of public buildings, like temples, like courts, pavilions, things made for public functions, were being adopted and used for private housing. So you had private houses looking like Greek temples, like Egyptian tombs, like medieval castles. It was a rather peculiar development, and architectural historians think it was a very unfortunate development to lose the indigenous styles of design. The second thing, probably the most important, is the Industrial Revolution. Up until that time, the house was essentially served those two functions. It was the shelter from the weather, it had a source of heat for warmth and cooking, and it was located near a source of water. It was located near a source of fuel, which I suppose in America would be mainly trees, and a source of food, which of course was garden. And it required a good, at least an adequate amount of land and natural surroundings here to support the existence of the household. Well, the Industrial Revolution first enabled, the first thing it did was to develop certain technologies. All of a sudden glass could be produced, instead of being in little panes, it could be produced in bigger and bigger panes. Steam and water-powered sawmills gave us standardized wood sizes, and wood could be cut, thousands of trees could be cut, where it took a carpenter to build a house. They had to go out and with a small crew, fell the trees, square up the lumber. It was a very costly and time-consuming operation. Now with the specialization that developed in the Industrial Revolution, the division of labor materials, hardware, glass, wood products, all were developed. There was a fast and easy supply for the elements of building. Victorian houses are a good example. They were at the time when electric and powered woodworking tools had all of a sudden come to a point where could operate rather efficiently. And you can see the result of that, in that Victorian houses are just plastered with wooden ornaments. They were like steam-driven or electrically-driven lathes, and just the ornament is overwhelming on some of those houses. And it was the direct result of having easily machined components. Well, but the most destructive result of the Industrial Revolution is the influx of utilities. One thing we didn't include here that will be important is a way to dispose of waste. And that was the way it used to be done. There, you can't find an antique waste basket, or because there wasn't that sort of waste. You just can't find one. They didn't know of such a thing. Everything was used, and what wasn't used was returned somehow. So what began was the influx of utilities. And I don't know exactly what order they came in, but I've got a particular order here just for ease of drawing it. First thing we'll say, and of course I have to take out some of this to make room. It may be significant that I have to do that. Electricity was one major utility. All of a sudden, power could and energy could be generated outside the home at a central generating plant, and these wires are strung to houses. What happened was that the energy that supplied the needs of the house was centralized. It allowed for all sorts of things to happen. And all of a sudden, daylight could be maintained 24 hours a day. And the whole life cycle of a rural area and an urban area especially was changed by that. Along with that came, I can't forget this, the meter here. And that was a way to tell how much electricity you'd use. And it was a mark of a growing dependence upon suppliers of these new utilities. Well, and there was water and piping. The central water main. Now, this had to go. The central water main that pipes water into the house. And of course, there was a meter for that, too, to tell how much water you used. Again, that your dependence on the water here was no longer necessary. It was able to live further away from any sort of reservoirs and resources. There was for sanitary reasons and also for convenience, we had sewer lines. All of a sudden, the waste no longer had to be disposed of in a multifaceted way. It could just be put down the tube. And it ran into a water main, and people began paying the city to maintain this particular part of it. And codes developed that insist that some sort of sanitary sewer accompany most houses. Most states have certain requirements for that sort of thing. An interesting thing happens here, too. With the disposal of human waste that way, fresh water is taken from here. It's mixed with human waste, put down the tube, it runs to a central location, and then tax money spends thousands of dollars to separate the good water from the human sewage again. It's awfully ironic that somewhere along the line you had to combine the fresh water and then you had to resort it out again. Then another thing, we're going to have to put a basement in here to hold the furnace. An artificial source of heat, other than firewood. Sorry, coal was mine. And coal was delivered, you either picked it up yourself or you were delivered, and that was made possible by transportation. Cheap, efficient transportation. Houses were next to roads. Trucks brought the coal along, dumped it in your basement, you shoveled it in the furnace, and you had a source of heat. Later on, that diesel fuel was used, which is a refined product from crude oil, and then natural gas, which is not refined from crude oil, but is found in separate deposits, which was bought by these utility companies and supplied to the house to run the furnace. It also changed the kitchen. And of course, there was a meter outside for that, too. And with the coming of the gas and the electricity, there are hundreds of proliferations of this of these utilities. You know, you could have hot water in your kitchen and in your bathroom. You could have an electric stove, a dishwasher, mixers, toasters, electric blankets. Magic Finger, Central Air, Garbage Disposal. Yeah, they had to have companion homes for the human beast of burden. They had little houses for the cheap transportation, for the automobile. Also auxiliary homes. When the size and the complexity of this became so burdensome, you could buy homes on wheels that you could attach on your automobile, and you could haul your home around with you. The net result was that you live in a very complicated and intricate house. And what it is a ponderous collection of artifacts and utilities that requires all sorts of specialists to intervene and to maintain it. Now the question to ask is, why does this situation develop? First of all, the availability of these resources, and they were cheap resources. Gas was inexpensive, electricity was inexpensive. The Industrial Revolution, we have to thank for that. Things were available, and we could use it. The second was the specialization. There were people who were able to install these sort of complex technologies in your home, and they also maintained them, instructed you when things went wrong, and it became difficult, if not impossible, to do all those things yourself. Another thing was that we were sold a bill of goods we were convinced that the urban model of lifestyle was good. All these things, because of the transportation, it allowed the cities to proliferate because we had the cheap transportation and all these utilities were available in the city. And somehow city living became the model for our society. Country living was kind of a second-class citizenship. Although country living met the needs for a long time in the more traditional way, it was, of course, it wasn't as acceptable or nice. Another reason for the development of the situation was convenience. Just nice to have free time. But it's interesting that what these things serve to do is to buy free time. And it testifies to maybe an aversion to labor that involved in the economics of a house. One of the problems with a lot of new technologies, new energy technologies, is the fact that they require a lot of what's termed owner intervention. That means if you're going to have passive solar technologies in your house, you have to be there on sunny days to open the shutters, and when it gets cloudy or starts to get dark, you shut the shutters. To throw valves, open valves and throw switches. And that sort of thing has been a block to the development of solar technologies because people just aren't willing to do that sort of thing. Talked a little bit about abundant resources, transportation, gas, coal, electric, water, lands and rivers where waste could be disposed of. I heard someone say once that the ability of our country's rivers to absorb sewage is one of the greatest natural resources we have, and it should be used to the fullest. And another thing, another reason for this development of the situation is the peculiar American use of things, especially possessions and certainly houses, as an indication of status. Your house is an extension of yourself. It tells you who you are. The house is not formed by the self. It does not become your tool. But the self is formed by the house. You are where you live. It's a peculiar American way of looking at possessions. But there have been costs to that development. The first thing is the exhaustion of those resources. It's not cheap anymore to have clean water, to have fuel to heat your furnace, to buy building material, and to buy electricity. Industry ultimately works for the existence of this. Our gross national product, our the health of our economy is all to serve the American home, our way of life, our standard of living. And right now, it seems that industry is maintaining itself and its strength by supplying this shelter with an endless parade of goods. First, the need is manufactured for them. You need a Mr. Coffee, and then industry will produce it. And our standard of living and our lifestyle has been supported in that fashion. Another cost of the development is boredom. One of the signs of the boredom, because you don't have anything to do in your house anymore, everything's taken care of, we've seen a proliferation of leisure time activities. You know, there's no wood to chop, there's no garden to hoe, so you join the racquetball club, or you go jogging, like taking your dog out for a walk. There's nothing to do at house. There's no way to get in touch with your primary needs. It's all left to specialists and technicians. And the sources of life, the source of food, shelter, and clothing, it's elusive, and it's hard for us to see how we actually meet the needs, because everything we do is transferred into, by proxy, into money. And we have to work at a specialty job to get money, and money is the thing that supplies our needs. It's impossible to live without it. Now, the third cost of the development is victimization, especially in urban areas, because you're totally dependent upon specialists. And you're especially dependent upon the beast of burden here, transportation. Certain things, the transportation of certain services to your home, like the gas, the water, the electricity, are taken care of for you. But the other thing, like provisioning the house with food, with other sorts of goods, depends upon the automobile. If you don't have your automobile or transportation, city living is tough. And I think what results, too, in that victimization, becoming dependent, it's not an interdependence. It's not a healthy relation of people together, helping meet one another's needs, but it's an honest to goodness dependence, and along with that comes a suspicion. Not community, but it's a vague suspicion that you're going to get taken to the cleaners when you have these things taken to the specialist to fix them. Fourth thing is fragmentation, the loss of connection with the earth and between the contributing makers of the household, because nobody has anything to do here. There's no common family activities. Everybody goes in every different direction. Usually, and Wendell Berry will see him saying this, that there's one person left in the nurturing role, in the provisioning of the household, and in what's left of the household role, and that's usually the woman. But she is, instead of becoming a nurturer and a provisioner, the one at home becomes a consumer and deals only in money. The breadwinner is out in the world, has very little to do here. Gets home, there's maybe the only thing to do is mow the grass or watch TV. You know? Children, they have their lives are full now of activities outside the home. So the connection is lost between the members of the household, between the land. Relationship to land was apparent in the first drawing. It's not so apparent now. Where we once engaged in making a living out of resources around us, now isolated and dependent. It's not a pretty picture, and I own a home. I have all these utilities coming in, and I feel it's a little bit of the boredom, the victimization, and the fragmentation. And I have to say that the answer would not be easy. But you have to also say that this sort of a lifestyle might be more a liability than an asset. If we can't afford to live in a home, and if somehow providing ourselves with shelter from the weather, a source of heat for warmth and cooking, has become outrageously expensive, it may be worth our time to take a look at alternatives to this. And I would just, I'd like to close by saying something hopeful, and that things can be different. There's no reason to lose hope completely. Any reaction? It's a lot the same as the first question.
Reminds me of a patient in an intensive care.
With all the tubes and wires and things. Has anyone been in that situation? You've seen people. Maybe, you know, that's maybe a good example, that you feel that fragmentation, you feel the utter dependence. You go into your basement and see pipes leading out, you know not where. And wires going off into space someplace.
In California, acreage is 50 by 100 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And so then there's about 1,000 of those in our neighborhood. 50 by 100, 50 by 100, 50 by 100. Hold on, you know. So a lot of folks got into that little plot of map.
Mm-hmm.
And all of us had a separate well. There were 6 feet between the top.
Mm-hmm.
And a pretty short old lumber.
Yeah.
So a lot of us had the illusion of privacy. We couldn't open our windows along the side. Because the major window in our house looked into the major window of the next house. So if we opened ours early in the morning, and if the people next door opened theirs, we'd say, hey, there's hell. Condominium people that lived in the newer, across the road in the newer street, that was at least smarter than us. They didn't have any illusions over there.
Yeah.
They also had a swimming pool and a jacuzzi and a green area.
Some sort of communal
arrangement. Our privacy was just an illusion.
Yeah. Now, you can make an argument that maybe our mistake is going with the single family detached house. Maybe that's not the way, maybe that just shouldn't be done anymore. That may be true. I think there are some costs to going to apartment living and not having the investment of a piece of turf. And that is that you still feel the victimization of fragmentation. And there is a sense in which you are disconnected. And you may have a tendency to be less responsible. You know, having your own piece of turf, even if it is only 50 by 100, your tendency is to think about it more differently. And that may say something about the problems in our urban areas, the consistent problem with public housing. I'm going to go back to something that you said earlier. There's been a lot of good things in housing. Yeah, now all of these things have positive, all of the utilities have positive aspects to it. And that's especially a good reason to be hopeful, because we know more about sanitation, we know more about nutrition. Just the average person knows more about sanitation, nutrition, energy, than any people before. We are a well-educated citizen. We are capable of making use of this sort of technology in ways that people that only had indigenous crafts and traditions and customs couldn't. The problem is that we haven't made use of it. We have used it to become, to make our lives very complicated and fragmented. To live like we had a house with 100 servants, all of it is supplied by mechanical mechanics. People that live in the comfort that we live now have service by the dozen, by the score. That provided water, provided food, provided the warmth in the bedroom that lit the fires in the stove. And we're living like the landed gentry of centuries earlier, but we're doing it without service. And the cost is no longer in human energy, but it's in all sorts of non-renewable energy. Just wondering if we need all this, if we can't put our technology much more appropriate and globally just useful.
So yeah, we are in a good position because we know a lot of stuff that we don't know before. We can get more lumber out of a tree today. We can get sometimes two-thirds as much, two-thirds again as much as was done 200 years ago. But there are also two-thirds as many, you know, twice as many trees going down too. Any other comments? Is this sort of...
Can we be more specific about, you said we're in a good position and we're close to initial presentation, and there are things that can be done, or is that a very future section?
Let me give you a kind of a rundown. Craig was going to talk Wednesday about how other cultures got approached to housing problems. Some of their innovative and their solutions to housing problems that haven't been part of the American experience. So that will be just a way to kind of take a critical look at what we have and maybe an imaginative look at what other people have to try to push out all sorts of conclusions about what a house should be like or what, you know, the function of a house and how housing problems are solved. That'll be Wednesday. And Thursday we'll have a forum on what does a house do? Not what does it look like, but what does a house do? And we'll talk about that and we'll do this thing. Does that answer? You asked, what can we do? I mean, we know a lot of stuff. We know, okay, well, for instance, we know how to get the most strength out of the least amount of material. We know, too, how to keep our water pressure. We know how to eat balanced meals. We know our nutritional requirements in a way the generations before us didn't know. We know where to place our septic system. We know how to raise food efficiently. We now have all sorts of new technologies in that respect. And so we've never been in a better position to run a household effectively, efficiently, and justly. Trouble if we have it.
Are there any really viable alternatives in an urban setting? With urbanization, most of this has gone from convenience to necessity. If you argue for a total return to rural life, more decentralization population, then your utility would no longer be a necessity, but not everyone can be located close to a source of water. Not everyone can be located close to you.
Good point. Are there any alternatives for urban dwellers short of moving to the country?
I expect that there are no alternatives about moving to the country because our population couldn't move to the country and the sources of water couldn't be next door because water has become something that is needed by too many people, so and too many different levels of the structure. So that we don't have an option to move back to simple living where we are surrounded by those things that will give us our necessity.
Yeah. Well, one book that that speaks to this issue of urban, of a self-sufficient urban house, and I don't remember the title of where I saw the book there someplace, but I mean, it had that, huh? Oh, that's it. Oh, it's a good set one. Okay, that's the one I have. Yeah. Integral urban house. Chickens and all sorts of stuff. Birds. Rabbits.
You ever tried to keep a chicken in the city?
We did. Well, now the citation. Did you? Norma Knutson arrested for keeping chickens.
Yeah, I knew a pediatrician that lived in downtown Puyallup and he raised turkeys in his yard. The people next door, and he's going to raise them for Thanksgiving, and the people next door fell in love with the turkey and they bought it and they moved next door.
There are people that object to that sort of thing. One of the things about urban living, and I'd be interested in input on that. I think urban living is supported solely by the existence of this sort of transportation. At least it's true in our culture that were it not for cheap transportation, the size of the city would be limited. Were it not for the internal combustion engine, the size of the city would be self-limiting. Cities only got so big, I said this last time. The shift to automobiles was actually heralded as a very clean form of transportation. It's ironic, but the problem with horse manure in larger cities that relied solely on horse transportation was stupendous. I forget how many pounds, like 20 pounds of manure a horse will put out in a day. And compare that, you know, for a horse, you know, the amount of harmful emissions per horsepower with a horsepower city compared to the amount of emissions per horsepower of an automobile. And you've got a massive problem. So the automobile is heralded as a real clean source of transportation, and it enabled the city to expand its limits unbelievably. And we're all of a sudden, that sort of transportation is ceased, city living would become a nightmare. And I'm not sure it could support itself. And this is one reason that at least our transportation crisis is so alarming. Because you really are, if you're downtown in a city of 500,000 people, you're not going to be the first one to the last can of beans at the grocery store. And you're, you know, a lot of people ahead of that, you know, ravaging the countryside, I'm sure.
One of the things that I hope you could do is to tell me, first of all, some basic conceptual things about house construction anything to say about how to build a self-contained, energy-efficient house. Okay, I'd like to know that. Also, I'd like to know who's got the information and where the expert and just walk into the bookstore and pick up. But I'm not really interested in rabbits and ducks and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of a nice idea, but I didn't get a mind if I really did. But I'd like to know where I can get more information. That'd be one thing I'd like to know.
Okay, is that a concern of other people here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you get Mother Earth News?
No, I don't.
They had just thousands of references and materials in there. They've got a booklet, and they offer a booklet and things like that on solar energy.
Okay.
I mean, not just everything.
Mother Earth News, but I haven't read the Integral Urban Health. That would be one resource to spot check.
Another thing I'd like to know about is a system of co-op building system. I would be willing and able to contribute 3 months of full-time labor to a project, to your project, for a year, if we had 4 houses that had to be built, and you could do 3 months on each house.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And with, like, barn raising, if you could go around and raise 4 houses in a year's time.
I put those four together, kind of like a
better idea, but
sure.
Okay, better idea, yes. I can't use a lot of real sophisticated ideas that are going to cost me $25 an hour to put into operation.
That's right.
I have to go hire somebody to do it.
That's right. There's no way to use this stuff. You just have to become knowledgeable. You got to be able to do it yourself. To supply any alternative. Normally, you know.
I guess my problem is just trying to talk about building a house together and stuff, but we are so little with legislation that is protective that there's no way that we can do these things. We can't do that plot and build unless it's just there is kind of zoning, and then everything you do, you can't put in electrical work unless you get an inspector that comes in, and so on. And it seems to me that if we're dealing with housing, we've got to deal, first of all, with a focus on what we're trying to accomplish in a much more global sense, and then we need to deal with the kind of legislation we need to enable us to maximize our housing. And since you asked, we don't know what it is we want to accomplish.
Okay.
I don't want to accomplish just building a house for me if I'm living in a city. You know,
because
that's just finding myself to the needs of the whole city.
In our conversation, Craig and I said that we need to do a little more demolition. We all have preconceived notions about housing should be, and our hope is that this, you know, the next session and then Thursday will bring us back down to the ground, you know, to clear away all the stuff, all the interference that we've had, all our preconceived notions about housing, and then begin at step one to talk about the function of housing and to do it with an eye to the needs of people throughout the world, to identify things that Americans have seen as their own particular needs, like private bedrooms, family rooms, entertainment centers, you know, and to look at those sorts of things and see if they're legitimate, you know, from a global perspective, or see if they're not. And to begin right at the ground level, saying what, as shelter, as a place to live, as a tool of your lifestyle, what should a house do? Not what should it look like, but what should it do? And when we start there, hopefully some really interesting things will happen. And we hope that that won't be the end of it. But then from that point, once we've kind of cleared away some of the misconceptions or preconceived ideas, then we can begin to talk about the limits. The limits, for instance, that on what materials will do. You know, there's some things that you can do with some materials that you can't do with others. The sun only shines in certain places. Water runs downhill. Those sorts of limits are going to have to combine with what you see as the function of a house. And through that, then the practical stuff comes. But sure, it'll be hard to sustain interest unless we do talk about some practical things.
Just when I was coming here, this convincing, I read that we are going to do more building in the next 20 years than we have done in the last 6,000 years of history. It means that the kind of decisions that we make are really rather important, because if that kind of building is still ahead of us in that year of time, we better get our act together.
Yeah. There's one qualifier, and the buildings are no longer built to last indefinitely. It's amazing. My grandmother was baptized in a church that was 600 years old when she was baptized. Now you can get a basement, a wood basement, guaranteed for 30 years.
Well, this is what that has to do, that whole theory about obsolescence, which is built into all the stuff we make. Cars and washing machines and houses.
Yeah, it goes along with looking at a house as an investment rather than something else.
I hear a couple of things here, and Joel and I need to kind of know what you people want to hear. What we're thinking about is the house as a tool to alternative lifestyle, and as an outgrowth of the kinds of thinking that you do here. So what you said, Joel, is you're concerned about the house as a social need and a social problem, and that's a whole other area. And that generally has to do with police and urbanization and the whole infrastructure that's been built up that in some ways is very good and in some ways is not so good in terms of human value. And that's, if there's interest in that, then that's a whole other.
Yeah, I was into that discussion, and that's where I'm coming from.
Yeah. That's an area that we could talk about, and that's a whole other area of interest. there are at least issues there that all of us need to be aware of, so that wherever we are in local politics and local planning decisions, we all need to be aware of who's making these decisions and who's benefiting from them and who's not.
Yeah, that may be, that's another area of giving that we talked about, Craig knows more about tonight, and that's the idea of legislation that limits and controls the kind of housing being built. That's a very restrictive giving that that's a work.
What else are people interested in the area of the house? Building your own house, designing and building your own house, is that something that people want to hear about, or are people more interested in housing as a social problem?
The stuff that you mentioned once about what you've done in the city, some things that are a serious and a step in the right direction, but they aren't just hard or evaluation
don't tear down one neighborhood and build a new one.
Right.
But there is a real concern for practical apply right now, and when I leave home and my things that I can do.